Hello, social chemist listeners. When it comes to combating misinformation, we have discussed various interventions from pre-bunking to the storytelling of the negative impact of conspiracy theories. On today's episode, we covered the topic of news media literacy, an intervention that you've probably heard of already through this podcast or state media. As I mentioned a few episodes back in my conversation with Todd Helmis from the RAND Corporation, AI technology is evolving. So, how will that impact our information ecosystem? Can news literacy media address the fast-adapting problem of misinformation? And what can educators do to help people distinguish between reliable information and disinformation? I hope you enjoy today's podcast as we learn a little bit more about the sociological problem of false narratives in public health, social media, and democracy. Hello, listeners. Welcome to this edition of the Social Chemist Podcast. I'm your host, Nelson. And on today's episode, we are joined by Demario Phipps Smith, a senior manager of community learning at the News Literacy Project, an organization that is dedicated to creating resources for educators to help students differentiate between reliable information and disinformation. In today's episode, we will discuss the importance of media literacy for democracy and how AI technology will change how we address misinformation. Demario, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Nelson. I appreciate the time. I'm looking forward to a really great conversation.
Yeah. Demario, I want to start by getting to know a little bit about you and your background. Now, I've been doing this podcast for 3 years, and I've spoken to a lot of scholars on misinformation, and I've noticed that the study of misinformation is really dominated by white academics. I'm curious to know if your background as a person of color has offered you a unique perspective in how disinformation, misinformation, and conspiracy theories impact minority groups.
Wow, that's a great question. I love that to start off. I would say in my time, I have kind of gained the experience that a lot of this work, like you said, is conducted and researched upon by white scholars. A lot of this work is done from the white academic standpoint. But I believe what you're seeing today as far as media literacy organizations and media literacy non-for-profits and what we do in news literacy, there's a special focus on communities of color, on marginalized communities, because what we found is during times of, let's say, elections, right? During election season, Black and Brown communities especially are being targeted for misinformation. So there are special cycles, special times where there is a disproportionate amount of misinformation that affects Black, Brown, and Black communities, but oftentimes you don't see, you know, people from those communities doing the research or teaching it or teaching against misinformation or teaching news literacy or media literacy. But I do believe that there are efforts to improve that initiative, and it is a growing field. The field of news literacy specifically is a growing field. Media literacy, I think, has been around since about the 40s or the 50s. So while that's a little bit more historic in the grand scheme of things, it still is a relatively new field as well.
I think about the COVID-19 pandemic and how the misinformation campaigns really, it impacted everyone, but when it comes to African-Americans and Hispanics, we know that COVID-19, for example, killed people of color 5 times more than white people. And, you know, we can dive into, you know, the social factors that contributed to that. But when you have this misinformation ecosystem online, when you're on lockdowns, when you're uncertain about, you know, what's going on, how did we get here, when we have the CDC and the World Health Organization, while they're producing, you know, they're providing information, sometimes it becomes a little bit confusing. You combine all these things and it leaves, you know, our communities in a very vulnerable situation to misinformation. And I'm glad that this is being addressed, because I do think that it's something that, you know, before you mentioned it, I didn't feel like was being addressed properly, because where I like to go when it comes to studying this topic is on conspiracy theories. And we often focus on Alex Jones or, you know, Peter McCullough, but there are, unfortunately, conspiracy theorists of color that I think have hijacked the mistrust that African Americans have with institutions. So one of the things that's often cited for anti-vaccine skeptics in the African American community is the Tuskegee experiment. That's often used to create distrust, and it's an effective narrative, unfortunately, but hopefully over time we can create this foundation of trust and providing, you know, proper information. Time will tell how that will look, but what you guys are doing, you know, it's great, and I'm glad to know that there's this organization focusing on that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, when you talk about people's fears, really their institutional cynicism towards things, that's a very real thing, right? People have experiences, be it anecdotal or historic. They have these experiences with institutions, and it forms their belief systems about them. And because, you know, no one person is in a vacuum, we oftentimes share our beliefs and feelings towards institutions with our friends, with our family members, with our coworkers. So that word of mouth aspect, that institutional cynicism that transforms into like a word of mouth thing, is pretty dangerous too. And so, like, a lot of our work is really helping people find credible sources of information, to find factual things that they deem trustworthy. So if they are going to share something with their network and their colleagues, we hope that is something fact-based, something from the standards-based news organization.
Since we're talking about media news literacy, you know, the basic question, you know, what does that encompass? What does that look like? And I'm curious to know if all schools in the U.S. currently have this program in place, or is it like in select communities and neighborhoods?
Great question. So a big thing about news literacy is using the correct terms and definitions for things. Our line of work at the News Literacy Project is to focus on news literacy. And news literacy we define as having the ability to determine the credibility of news and other information, and to react, to recognize the standards of fact-based journalism, to know what to trust and what to share. Media literacy more specifically speaks to promoting a type of thinking that's critical about all media messages that people might encounter in their daily lives. So this is stuff from advertising, news, pieces of entertainment, films, TV shows. Most approaches to media literacy really underscore this need for students to question media by considering issues of power and representation and things like that. But news literacy more specifically focus on finding credible sources of information. So when you speak to how does this look like in schools, well, I think it's like you mentioned, I think misinformation is one of the critical crises of our time. And so it's important that we start building a movement around to combat it. We're already deep within that movement. We have more than 400,000 students who have used our virtual classroom called Checkology since 2017. We have nearly 60,000 educators in all 50 states, DC, Puerto Rico, and 127 other countries who have joined our NewsLit Nation Educator Network. And as far as some more numbers, during the 2021-22 school year, educators using our content, training, and our program reached an estimated 2.4 students. But this news literacy movement doesn't just end in the classroom. My work as a senior manager of community learning, I work specifically with adult communities to help give them news literacy skills, because as we've seen with the last couple elections, misinformation is a huge problem, and it's not just something we need to worry about on a youth level. This is something that we need society to be educated on, all parts of society to be educated upon. So another one of your questions was about how or do all schools have them? Unfortunately, no, not every school is mandated to have a media literacy program. We have been working with a number of them, and we keep abreast to the changes in policy that's happening across the country. We're really encouraged by the work that's happening in Illinois, Maine, Texas. I think California just mandated that high school students have media literacy or news literacy in their program as well. So the movement is growing, right? And in order to get this established in schools, we need support from advocates who believe in the value of news to our democracy. We need help from conscious members of the community who realize the issue and how important it is. And then we need allies on the state and educational levels as well to help partner with us so that we can get this training in front of all people. But that's kind of how it looks in schools. It's a multi-pronged approach of building collaboration, right? Building community with people, talking with them, helping them understand the issue of news literacy, because it's not a partisan issue. This is something that we believe everyone needs and is a big, big issue for all people. And increasing our skills individually and as a country is paramount to us combating misinformation.
You stated that not all schools in the country have this program. I'm curious to know if you've noticed that the communities that are missing the media literacy program are communities that would be considered like minority groups. Are they less likely to have these types of programs in their school systems compared to more like wealthy neighborhoods? If that question made sense.
Yeah, no, that question makes a lot of sense. It would be hard to tell. I don't have any hard numbers from that. But when we think about things like media literacy and news literacy, where would they sit at? And a lot of times that's in the civics program. And a lot of schools across the country have kind of shuttered their civics program, right? To save money, budget concerns are a concern for every educational system in the country, it seems. So a lot of programs like news literacy has been cut out, right? From my understanding, the places that have the funding and the structure for that it might very well be the case that they have more resources to allocate to something like that. I can't say for sure that that marginalized communities have them at a lower number. But if you think about the fact that a lot of schools have ended or shuttered or closed their civics learning program or courses, you would think that it was a budget thing. And so schools that don't have as high a budget or don't have as much open so that they can improve on that, I think are the ones in question. Are they necessarily communities of color? In some cases, yes, but it's a very simple answer for a very complex thing. I think that is really an issue of budget concerns, I believe.
When I think about news media literacy, it's an intervention to combat misinformation. And another intervention that's used, it's called inoculation theory or pre-bunking. And for the listeners, it's essentially you expose a person to a small version of misinformation. And then when that person is exposed to the actual misinformation narrative, they're able to detect it and be aware that this is the narrative that's being sold to them. One of the limitations to that, DeMario, is that this implies that people have been exposed to the small version of this misinformation before they're exposed to the actual narrative. Now, we know that misinformation unfortunately travels a whole lot faster than reliable information. And so when it comes to media literacy, one of the limitations that I see is that who's the one that are funding this program. Now, from a, if I was a conspiracy theorist, for example, right, you know, I would look at, you know, who NLP is like partnered up with, and then I would see that, oh, you know, it's they partner up with like the New York Times or ABC News. And then from a conspiratorial standpoint, I'm here thinking, well, wait a minute, that's the enemy. That's who I distrust. How does NLP address this issue, and can it even be like effectively overcome?
Wow, that's a really great, astute observation. The first thing I would let you know is that the News Literacy Project is a nonpartisan education nonprofit. So we believe on our very core principles that it takes both sides of the aisle. We need both conservative and progressives, and whatever is in the spectrum in between that, we need everyone to work together so that we can combat misinformation as a country. I think when you think about the limitations that news literacy has, or some of the obstacles it has to overcome, I think it's really this mindset is helping correct people's mindsets and their hearts towards news literacy. I mean, because we believe that it's a nonpartisan issue, we don't really believe it should be a political divide. We should all want to find credible information that we can use to be more active and engage citizens in our community. That's, to us, that's not a political thing. So really helping affect people's minds and their hearts toward the issue, I think, is a huge shortcoming. Clearly is, you know, unless we do a really good job at teaching this, we know there are going to be some people that we're not going to reach because they just are so dogmatic in their approach and what they believe. But we do believe that getting this in front of as many people as possible to create a movement around it is a really effective way to go. And I think another limitation is like what you said, right? Is this idea of what bias and what's driving this work, right? And so if you were to look at who our partners were or what we've done in the past, we've done a lot of things with a lot of different organizations, newsrooms who people might consider to be more conservative, newsrooms who people might consider to be more liberal. But at the same time, we realize that this work takes credible sources. It's not us teaching you, you know, in news literacy, we believe in this core tenet that we don't teach you what to believe or who to read, but we teach you how to think about what is trustworthy and credible for you. So we're not telling you to read this or that. We're just telling you, hey, here's a way for you to determine what you can conceive as trustworthy or reliable information for you. And so, yes, we work with reputable standards-based news organizations, but that's not that we work with, we don't try to partner more with liberal newspapers or partner more with conservative news outlets. We want to give people an understanding of how journalism works, you know, to peel back the curtain a bit, and to also help people understand the importance of news and credible information to the function of our democracy.
It's interesting because currently, I think Jim Jordan's the one that's going on a rampage against misinformation researchers. And one of the things that he claims is that misinformation conspiracy theory researchers are censoring conservative speech. And so I wonder how that's going to look in the long run as this country, unfortunately, when it comes to polarization, we do see that polarization is increasing. So how much more difficult is it going to make? How many people are you going to reach? I mean, time will tell. But I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned a little bit a moment ago, which is media literacy for adults, because you actually answered one of my questions that I was going to ask you. You know, what is the long-term effect of media literacy outside of education? Because let's take, for example, gym, right? Studies have shown that our youth is generally healthy during grade school. And one of the factors is because we offer gym program during the curriculum. But once you graduate high school, you no longer have gym, and it's no longer something that's part of your life. But now that you told me that you work with adults in this area of combating misinformation, I'm just curious to know what that looks like.
Another great question. So typically we'll partner with almost any group. We mostly focus on professional and like unions and stuff like that. So I've worked with AARP, the Women Leagues of Voter, Women's League of Voters, and several other adult servicing like organizations. But what that looks like in practice is trainings, webinars, in-person events, where I'm helping people identify credible sources of information, how they can spot misinformation, and then helping them understand the importance of credible information and a free press to our democracy. So yeah, it could be, it is, I've had trainings anywhere from like 20 minutes to 2 hours. And I think the best thing that comes out of them most of the time are the discussions, right? Just people learning from each other, learning from their peers about things they've been through or things they've seen. And so I think the discussion portion of it, I always learn a lot about other people and their concerns about the news or their concerns about bias in the news. So it's very engaging work. It can be challenging, but very necessary, especially ahead of this election.
Your work is definitely important for many communities, people that can't differentiate between, you know, what's real information and what's, you know, false. And that brings us to another aspect of our conversation, which is AI technology. Now, AI technology is catching everything by storm. And it's really a bipartisan issue because currently Senator Amy Klobuchar and Senator Josh Hawley are working on a legislation to ban all AI imagery on political campaigns. But at the same time, AI technology isn't introducing a new problem. As we've discussed, right, you know, misinformation has always existed. And so I'm curious to know, how do you think AI technology will change how we combat misinformation? Will it make it harder for all of us? Like, what are your thoughts on this issue?
Another really great question. So I've listened to a lot of talks on AI, especially around AI in the newsroom. I would say that AI, the way how I look at it is it's a tool, but it's a tool that is just as exciting as it is scary, right? There's just as many cool opportunities and applications for it as things or as examples of how it can be used really poorly and maliciously. When we're speaking about education specifically, I think some of the issues with AI really come from the ethics of it, right? So when I was in school, plagiarism was a thing. And even then, when I was like in high school, before social media, there were certain software where that could write papers for you, right? And so like we would get in trouble for plagiarism if you use that type of software. But with now, because AI scrubs the web, you know, a lot like how you would research for a paper, it kind of just does that for you. It's harder to tell what's plagiarism, right? Or what constitutes as plagiarism now when you get an AI tool that's literally probably doing almost exactly what you would do in research, but it's not you actually conducting the research. So I think the ethical concerns about AI are really there's a lot of problems with it, but I think the biggest concern or the things to be watch out for is the ethical considerations around accessibility, as well as accountability, right? From the public or the private sector, accountability and accessibility around ethics, I think is really important.
What tips would you give for educators that are going to be facing this challenge with AI technology? You know, we talked about plagiarism, but you know, when we talk about media literacy, we're also talking about how do we inform people to detect false narratives or false images or just fake information. What kind of resources can you offer educators?
The first thing I would say is to play with the software yourself. Do not be afraid of it. You have to understand how these things are used, what drives them, right? Like I said, this is just as great of an opportunity. This AI age is just as great of an opportunity as it is something for us to be cautious of. It's really about how we operate this tool, how we use this tool, that's really going to make a difference in how people view it going down the line. So the first thing is to play with the stuff, get familiar with it, learn it. The second is to really make yourself knowledgeable on the ways that people try to manipulate AI. So, you know, get a social media account if you don't already have one. And if you scroll for enough time, you'll see examples of poor use of AI. You'll see people create false narratives, put things in the wrong context. And so if you learn the tricks, you know, just get familiar, follow the field, I think is a really good thing to do. And then, like, you'll learn stuff like AI isn't good with, like, being detailed about hands and faces and tattoos and stuff. Once you learn stuff like that, you'll also learn about other things, like the fact that there are programs that are getting really good at doing those things. So really just keeping abreast with what's going on in the industry, I think, is important when you're trying to teach this stuff, because it's a technology. It's changing. It used to be technology changes every 6 months, but it seems like it's happening faster than that. So being really familiar with the tech is important. And then to follow fact checking and news literacy and media literacy organizations like the News Literacy Project. We have trainings, we have curriculum, we have tools and tips and everything that you can use for free to give to your students and to educate people in your network.
Last question, and this might be, you know, out of field, being that you focus on education, but you are a journalist. And so when it comes to AI technology, like you said, it's some people are screaming that's the end of the world. Some people are excited about this. But when it comes to economic injustice and economic inequality, I'm curious to know, how do you think AI will impact the profession of journalism? Because currently there's an app that provides AI therapy, and there's a lot of good things about it. You know, for example, if people don't have, you know, health insurance, they can try the app and see how it works for them. But at the same time, you look at the other side and think, well, there's that human connection that you're missing. And so we still don't know how things are going to work out. But one of the big things that's being said is that AI is going to take away our jobs. And how do you think, as a journalist, how do you think that's going to play out?
Oh, man, that is a really good question. I love this question, because a lot of misinformation plays on your emotion, right? And so a lot of times when we see things that can disrupt our industries, we get fearful of it, right? And a lot of things like this, especially around AI, where we're going to lose our jobs. Well, there might be industries where that's very true. I think the service industry, when you think about it, you know, when you go to McDonald's now, there aren't as many cashiers. There's more machines than there are people working the front working the cashier. But in an industry like journalism, where creativity and style and prose and storytelling are so important to the craft, I can't see a future where journalists' jobs would be threatened by AI. I do, however, see a future in which functions of journalism will be replaced by AI. So as an example, sports journalism has been doing this probably for maybe the last 5 years or so. They will use AI machine learning to amalgamate all the different scores. So for instance, your local paper in Southern Illinois, you can't go to all the high school games on a Friday, but what you can do is use a machine to crawl the internet or to scrub the internet for all of the results and all of the numbers, the statistics based on these things. And whereas, yeah, you weren't able to go to all these games, you can include that in like a weekly roundup or a small section about, you know, all the different schools in the area. And sports journalists have been using tools like this for a while now. We're seeing other facets of the newsroom also incorporating some element of machine learning. But when it comes to AI, you really have to understand the technology and use the right language to describe it, right? Like what I'm talking about is more machine learning, is taking information that's out there and compiling it into some type of list or form or document, which isn't really as much of an ethical concern. I mean, especially if you're letting people know, hey, these stats were compiled via this platform we use or we pay for or whatever. But I would say I wouldn't be as concerned about journalists losing their jobs. I think there are plenty of industries and markets where that might be a real concern. But because journalism requires that human touch of artistic expression, of word choice, of nuance and context, and most importantly, and one of my favorite parts of journalism is the storytelling. Machines cannot tell stories well. Like they can give you, it's going to get very formulaic. It's going to be very like almost scientific in a way. And writing, even journalism, is kind of an art form. Like there are, you know, standards and, you know, the way that they go about making articles, but it's kind of an art form too. And I think a lot of that will be lost, the touch of reading news, right? Or reading a report or reading an article. A lot of that would be lost. That human touch would be lost if robots or AI was doing it. So I wouldn't be as concerned.
Yeah, you know, you make a great case that human connection and that artistic touch that AI just doesn't have. But time will tell, you know, we'll see. Like you said before, technology used to evolve, you know, every 6 months. Now it's feels like it's every 3 months, and it's going to get faster. But DeMario, thank you so much for your time. You know, this was a great conversation. Before I let you go, can you let the listeners know one more time where they can find your work and your organization?
Yes, you can check out the News Literacy Project at newslit.org. All of our resources, tips, tools, training are completely free for the public. So if you're interested in learning more about news literacy, please get involved. If you have any educators or students that might be interested in the subject, please connect them as well. I'm not as active on social media these days, so I would say the best way to reach out to me is on LinkedIn, DeMario Phipps Smith. If you just do a quick search for me, you'll find me. I'm really good about messages. If you just reach out, I'll usually respond pretty promptly.
Well, awesome. Well, DeMario, again, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for what you do for, you know, our communities. We appreciate your work, and we look forward to, you know, hearing from you.
Thanks so much, Nelson. I really appreciate this. This was a great conversation, and I look forward to keeping up with your podcast as well, man.
Hi there. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. For more information on News Project Literacy, you can find a link to their website on the show notes below. Their website provides various resources for educators, librarians, and everyone who wants to help people distinguish between reliable information and disinformation. As DeMario stated, all these tools are free of charge, so if you're interested in implementing this in your classrooms, you know where to go. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, be sure to subscribe and leave me a 5-star review. By doing so, you help expose this podcast to people who might be interested in misinformation within politics and education. If you're listening on any other platform, be sure to subscribe to get more analysis on a conspiratorial mindset. You can follow me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Thread at The Social Chemist. For my newsletters, you can find me on Substack. For this episode, the references can be found in the show notes below. Be sure to share today's episode with an educator to have some interesting discussions about today's topic. So, with that being said, take care, be safe, and question everything with logic.